This week on the Boag World Show, we're joined by Brett Honnard to discuss justifying your costs, extracting info from your clients, and getting everyone moving in the same direction. This week's show is sponsored by Quilla and Envision. Hello and welcome to the Boag World Show, the podcast about user experience, digital strategy, and a whole lot more. My name is Paul Boag. Joining me as always is Marcus. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. That just felt weird.
What, the new introduction?
I know I'll get used to it, but it just feels wrong, and I'm unsettled now.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry about that. It was Bob's fault. Bob from the Boag World Slack channel.
Yeah, yes.
Pulled us up, didn't he, on our intro.
Saying, yes. It's not good UX, or it wasn't good UX.
No,
in the fact that it didn't describe what it was.
Undescriptive, or yeah, because we don't have a lot for developers. Although I'm hoping to rectify that problem. I've got a plan. I've got a cunning plan. But anyway, before we get into that, we need to welcome our other guest, which is Brett Honnard. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you?
Yeah, good, very good indeed. Awesome. So you were just saying that you're about to go on a holiday weekend.
Absolutely.
Where are you going? So you're going to the beach.
Where's the beach? I don't even know where you are, Brett.
I live in Philadelphia in the States, and the New Jersey shore is about an hour from here. So it's an hour drive to Ocean City, New Jersey.
Wow.
So you're actually staying there or just doing a day trip?
Stay in there. We have friends who live there, so we go down quite often.
Oh, I see. Making the most of other people.
Exactly. I was doing that last week. I was staying.
I'm a project manager. That's what we do. Make the most of
other. That's right. Very true.
Yes. Yeah. I was in a villa in a friend's villa in Spain all last week. That it is particularly nice. But staying in someone else's in villa when they say things like, "I just want you to be here to make it feel lived in." It's like, okay, lovely.
Well, so, villa in Spain trumps the Jersey Shore, let me tell you that.
Well, yeah, I was saying this to, we have a couple of American clients, and I was saying, your view of Spain is not the same as our view of Spain.
No, not at
it's
all.
Kind of like our view of Mexico isn't the same as your view of Mexico. We think of Mexico right. As kind of uber exotic, and you guys don't, do you?
No, not really. So that's fun.
Same thing.
It's further away somewhere is, the more exotic it is.
Yeah.
True.
I'm sure it's all to do with geography. Well, I tell you what lesson I've learnt already on this show, which is that me and Sam last week were talking about how antisocial we are, and you've just proved that having friends pays off because you get nice places to go and stay.
Yeah,
so, very true. So, very true.
Try harder, Paul. Get out there.
Yeah, make friends and mooch off of them.
Yeah, well, that's kind of that, yeah. That's a good attitude towards life, there, Brett. So, what are you up to these days, Brett? What's going on in your world? Because we both started doing our own thing at about the same time.
We did, yeah.
But neither of us seem to be kind of running back to work for someone else yet. So, how's it going with you?
No, not yet. I'm really doing well. I'm busy. I think, as you know, I'm writing my first book.
Yeah.
For Rosenfeld Media. It's called Project Management for Humans. I'm about halfway through. It's been a really good process so far, and I'm excited about what I've written and can't wait to share it. But then also, you know, I do consulting work. So I work with agencies and internal teams at corporations and product companies to help them sort out things like how to be better communicators, how to sort of pick a process that works, identify what it means to be a project manager within an organization, because I think it varies from place to place. I'm doing a lot of that work and having a lot of fun with it. And out of that comes some coaching work as well. So I'm working with some project managers to kind of help them on a weekly or monthly basis just to kind of sort out some career goals, talk about some challenges, and kind of help set them on the right path.
That's basically boils down to being a therapist, I reckon. I reckon that
sometimes it does.
Yeah, in my head, it's just them moaning about the staff that they have to manage the whole time, because that's what project managers do, isn't it? Moan.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's, you know, like I have a client that's really tricky. Therapy, right? But you know, sometimes it's helping them to just pick better ways to manage projects that, you know, will help them sort of build better relationships and gain trust with the people they're working with. Because unfortunately, PMs sometimes start at a point where they're not trusted or people don't know what they do. So I'm doing a lot to kind of help turn that around for people, which I really enjoy.
Good. Yeah, I enjoy the kind of mentoring coaching stuff is a lot of fun. It's a good thing to do.
It is
one of my favorite bits.
Me too. It makes you feel like you're actually helping people and making an impact on a personal level, I think is really cool.
Yeah, because I know what you mean. It's more than just kind of delivering a website or something. It's actually helping someone's day-to-day life, which is always a nice thing to do. Yeah.
I don't know if Sam mentioned this too, but related to that, we are starting a training program called Pathfinder DPM. So he and I have been working really hard to pull that all together, and we're hoping to get started in earnest at the end of this year. So we'll be doing in-person trainings in the States and in the UK.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, I'm excited to get started with that.
Ooh, but I thought Sam's got a fancy new job. He hasn't got time for this kind of thing, has he? Now he's working for Marks and Spencer's.
Yeah, well, you know, he's going to make some time to do it because he's excited about it too. So
cool.
It's a little extra effort for both of us, but I think it'll be worth it in the long run.
Yeah.
When's the new book going to be out, do you think?
So that should be out in 2017. My goal is to wrap it up this summer. I actually just had a conversation with Marta, my editor, and asked her to push me this summer to really just crank everything out and get it done. So
I'll race you then.
Okay.
Because I haven't started mine yet, but I set aside most of June and July to just blitz it. So we'll see who can get our book out first.
Okay. I mean, you've got much more experience than me, so.
That is true. That is true. But on the other hand, also yours will be better quality, won't it? Let's be honest.
I mean, probably.
I just churn out any old shit, and I basically.
Save me saying it, Paul.
Yeah, exactly. I'll say it myself. Hey, do you know, I've got some exciting news. It isn't that exciting. But we finally know, Marcus, how many episodes we've produced.
I know. I saw this in the notes, and this demonstrates my level of OCD-ness that I had to go and count them.
And Clinton who told me this.
I kind of lost. I was doing it in my head, and I think it's right.
Right. So, well, he had a spreadsheet.
Okay.
He knew what he was talking about. This is Clinton from Twitter, who informs me that this episode we're recording today is our 384th episode.
Wow.
I think is probably a sign of some kind of mental illness.
Well, we've got to keep note of when 400 is. 300 went past without us even noticing.
Yeah. So we're going to do something for 400, I've decided.
So that'll be probably mid the next season, won't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I've got some all kinds of cunning plans, which I have not discussed in any way with you, Marcus.
Okay.
But not just for the 400, but bigger and better things for the Boag World Show.
Okay.
So I'll leave that to you later. I'd just leave that hanging, or I could announce it on air as if it's in a fait accompli without even discussing it.
And I can't have any say in it whatsoever.
No, that'd be good. Anyway, let's talk about this season.
Yes.
Before we talk about the future. So this is the second show in our new season, and we're talking about, really because of Brett and because of Sam that we had on last week, we're talking about project managery stuff. But a little bit broader than that, and it's all born out of the fact that There's so much stuff if you're a designer. There's so much stuff if you're a developer. There's huge amounts if you're a marketer. But there really is very little in comparison for those of us that manage digital services. Now, whether that be in-house or whether that be working a project manager as an agency or whether you're just managing a digital team, there are all kinds of issues around culture, around project management, around people that are huge issues that aren't particularly well addressed. So that is what we're doing in this season. We're just basically taking your questions and answering those questions. And we're getting different people on the show to help us do that. And obviously this week it's Brett. So we really need some more questions from you, you guys, around those kinds of issues. And you can submit a question by going to boag.world/questions and submit your questions in the comments on that post. Okay. So, Brett,
yes,
are you ready? Are you ready for this? Are you ready to give us amazing answers about the future of
whatever it is you do? Yeah.
Whatever it is. Yeah, I hope so.
Right. Okay, that's cool.
I'll do my best.
That's good. But before we do that, let's quickly talk about one of our sponsors and then we'll dive into our question time. So our sponsor this week, again, is Envision, an amazing suite of productivity and design tools. Last week, I talked about how easy it was to actually create those designs, those kind of clickable prototypes, just by uploading essentially your design comps and making them interactive and doing all kinds of cool stuff with them. But this week, I want to also talk about how Envision is an amazing collaborative tool, and that it's not just a tool that you can test prototypes with, it's a tool that you can discuss those prototypes with stakeholders. So for example, stakeholders can go in and comment directly on the design itself. So instead of, you know, do you remember Marcus, when we got a fax through from a client once with annotations on? Do you remember that?
I do, but I can't remember which client it was. Was it one we could mention?
No, probably not.
Probably not, no. You never can you? The good
thing. Have you ever had that, Brett? A client send through design alterations as a fax?
Probably not since, like, 1999.
I just love that. That just makes me laugh so much. So essentially, instead of doing all that kind of stuff and then scribbling stuff or putting notes and you misinterpreting notes, they can actually comment directly on the designs themselves. You could get an overview of all the comments being made across all of your designs in one place, or you can drill down into a specific project or specific people. So you can see comments just made directly to you. So very, very useful for kind of seeing where you're going with the design and collaborating over the design. And that's not – I'm not just talking about clients here. I'm talking about any stakeholders. So, for example, Mr. Designer, wouldn't it be good if your developer could comment on a design before it's shown to a client and the client signs off on it and then you discover that the developer can't build it for whatever reason? Getting your content person to be able to comment on designs, all of that kind of stuff. So much of what Envision offer is free forever, but there is also all kinds of extra stuff that you can get if you sign up, things like unlimited prototypes, mobile user testing, all kinds of different bits and pieces. And you can get 3 months of that kind of unlimited package for free by going to boag.world/envision and entering the code INV-BOAG. Okay, quite enough of sponsors. Let's talk about digital project management. So, Brett, have you got any conferences coming up before we get into the questions? Because one of the things that I'm really conscious of is a lot of people don't know how many cool digital project management conferences are out there. And there's this real need for there to be places that digital project managers can go and talk with one another. And I wondered what you had coming up.
Yeah, so I'm currently planning the 4th annual Digital PM Summit. That'll take place October 13th to the 15th in San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
We're taking a little bit of a new approach this year, starting fresh with a brand new speaker lineup, which is probably why you haven't heard from me. Just trying to mix it up since we've had a lot of repeat visits over the past few years, and there are a lot of ideas kind of that have been submitted to us. So we're going to start announcing speakers next week, but we've already sold a good number of tickets. So I'm excited for that one. But also, you know, there are other events in the sphere that are popping up all over the place. So we were just in Sweden a month or so ago for an event that they did there called the DPL Forum for Digital Project Managers. And then, you know, as you know, DPM UK is an event that happens every year. So it's exciting. I think, you know, if you're not able to get out to one of the larger events, I think a lot of smaller kind of meetup groups are cropping up in cities. I know that they're all over in the UK and the US. Every time I do a workshop or a talk, you know, somebody comes up to me and says that they're interested in starting a new group. So I think it's so cool. And I think there's a long ways to go. I think there are a lot of DPMs out there who don't know about everything that's happening, but I think it's going to get bigger and bigger, which is exciting. I'm so happy to be a part of it, you know?
Is there much in the way for agency founders as well? You know, those people that are kind of managing teams but wouldn't necessarily call themselves a digital project manager?
Yeah, so the Bureau of Digital, which is the organization that I work with to host the PM Summit, is hosts an event called Owner Camp. Mm-hmm. And that's basically a 3 to 4 day kind of a retreat event for owners of agencies of, I think, 10 employees and up. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially a couple of days of roundtable discussion about anything that you might sort of have concern over or want to get ideas or discuss with other agency owners. So, you know, anything from billing and contracts to legal and human resources and, you know, all kinds of really great topics. And I will say that I've been to a few of those events kind of as like a fly on the wall, just helping out. And I've learned a ton from them, but I also see this amazing sense of community build over a few days that you necessarily wouldn't expect out of people who might view themselves as competitors in some ways. but it's really cool. I mean, and they really like keep the conversation going through, you know, avenues that the Bureau offers, like Slack and Basecamp. So yeah, that's been really great to see and be a part of too.
I went to something called the Founders Assembly over here in the UK, which was an event run by Clear Left, very similar to the Owners Camp.
Okay, cool.
And that was absolutely wonderful. You know, I found it one of the best conferences I think I've ever been to. Just being able to spend time with other owners and discussing the kind of challenges and problems that they face. There is kind of one group that I don't feel is particularly well represented with events and stuff, which is kind of those that run in-house digital teams. I can't think of anything dedicated to them. Can you?
Not really, but you know what I've noticed in the States is that the bigger events like an Event Apart or Converge, you'll find a lot of those people on in-house teams are going to those events that I think for a while were really more kind of web industry or agency specific. I think there's a little shift in that way. And we do at the DPM Summit, we see a good amount of in-house project managers or people who are even managing teams because the content's still relevant. It's just sometimes it's a little more difficult for people to sort of draw the connection of the work when it comes to like clients versus stakeholders.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes the difference might be, you know, within an agency setting, having a specific budget for a project, whereas on an in-house team, it's more about you have limited resources and a limited timeline rather than a budget to track against. But still, I mean, the core of what we talk about is the same.
Yeah. I mean, it was quite interesting. There was one digital project management summit I was at, one event somewhere, I get more confused, where that issue of not having budget does actually kind of change the experience quite a lot, you know, of because you can't say, yeah, sure, we could do that, but it's going to cost you more. So it's harder to turn away things and say no to stuff because you can't use money as a gentle way of saying go away.
Right, exactly. So and does, that person tends to be your boss too, right? Or someone's boss in the organization. So that makes it a little more difficult as well.
Yeah. Anyway, should we do some of the questions that we've got? So the first one is from Bruno. And he says, as a digital service grows, the pressure pulling it in different directions increases as more stakeholders get involved. And so he wonders, is there a process or a structure that can kind of mitigate that and this kind of almost instead of scope creep, it's like stakeholder creep, more people right. getting involved in the project? It's quite an interesting question, that one. And I just wonder what your thoughts were on it, Brett.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think the first point is people complicate everything, right? Mm. You know, people will make your projects complicated no matter what, but the more you add to them, I think the more tricky it gets. I don't know that there's a specific process for handling that or defending a project from people sort of coming in and being a part of it. But I do think the best processes you can put in place are around communications. So maybe first identifying who the project stakeholders are and out of them who the decision makers are going to be. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important place to start because then you start to understand who the most important voices are. Of course, that doesn't prevent you from having new people join the team, but I think if you come up with ways to engage new people and onboarding them to the project, that can be hugely helpful. I managed a project once with an organization who said that they were flat, so no hierarchy, everyone had equal decision-making power.
Oh, no.
Exactly. So I kind of called bullshit on that right away because I knew that it was going to be problematic for us to get a project done within a timeline without knowing who everyone was and what their role was going to be on the project. So I created a simple exercise to basically be in a room, in a conference room with basically the core project team. I listed on the whiteboard primary stakeholders, secondary stakeholders, management, executive, and board. So thinking like these are all categories that people might fit into. Mm-hmm. And it set up this, construct for how we might see people in the organization providing input at different levels throughout the course of the project. And for a flat organization, I thought it might be a little tough for them, but right away they started coming up with names and we started filling the names out underneath all of the sections. And when it came to the higher level people, that's where it got a little more difficult because people tend to be scared of those people, right? So they can identify them, but they're not sure that they want to identify them because they're not sure when and how they want to actually engage them in the project. So I was able to force that conversation. So, you know, because I can picture in that situation, you know, 5-6 steps down in a project where things are settled, having a high level stakeholder like a dean at a university or a board member in a corporation saying, well, why didn't you show me any of this work before? I'm not happy with what you have. And then that puts you back at square one. So, you know, part of that exercise is talking through those scenarios and helping them to understand what you've seen and then kind of getting on board with what you can do to kind of make sure it doesn't happen on your project. Mm. I think, too, on the communications thing, setting up maybe like daily, weekly, or biweekly status updates can be really helpful. If you think about it in terms of what your stakeholders want to know and when they should expect those communications. Just setting up a simple report that kind of tells them what happened last week, what's happening now, what's coming up. basically the things that they need to know at a very high level in bullet points. And then maybe a quick update on where you are, percentage complete through your project, and where the budget is with that, if that's relevant. And then talking through any risks, you know, like what are the things that are happening now that are blockers for next steps, or what are the things that are coming up that you're a little bit concerned about? I think being really, really clear about that helps to generate buy-in. And like I was saying before about trust, like just being really open and honest about what's happening can generate trust and interest in the project. So I think that stuff really helps. I think, too, I've been on really large projects, probably like Bruno's talking about, where there's a revolving door of stakeholders. And, you know, I got to a point where I just kept onboarding new people, where I started creating an ongoing document of what had happened on the project, sort of at a deliverable view. And it documented things like the conversations that we had, maybe any conflicts that came along with those conversations, and like who wasn't in agreement, who was the final decision maker, and then what happens if this new stakeholder comes in and wants to change that decision, what the impact will be on the project. I have a couple of resources on my blog, which is at brettharned.com/blog. Under the workshop resources article, there are some things that could be helpful for Bruno and people who are in situations like that. So definitely check that out.
I'd say perhaps it's my background from as a kind of user experience person, but one of the ways that I've often found you can limit stakeholder creep is by bringing it back to the user the whole time. That instead of everything being decided, oh well, we ought to get so and so's opinion on this. What does so and so's opinion really matter, or does is it the user's opinion that really matters here? So using that as a basis, I find makes a big difference.
Definitely.
I'll tell you the other little trick I use often downplaying the project as well, especially at the early days of it. That let's say you were rolling out, I don't know, let's do it, take a typical web design project. You were redesigning the corporate website. So, you know, all and sundry want to express an opinion on it. You know, everybody cares about the website. Everybody wants to sell on it. So the way that I tend to start projects like that is talk about, well, we're just building a prototype for now, you know, so we're just experimenting. And so you get some project momentum behind it, you know, because people, well, they don't care quite so much about the prototype, and you don't need to worry about whether it's exactly in line with the corporate branding or whether it's, you know, going to integrate into every back-end system. You can just concentrate on creating the user experience and getting some data to back up the decisions that you've made before you then start rolling stakeholders into the mix let them express their opinions and get involved as well. And I often find that once you've got a kind of working prototype in place and you've got some data from user testing, a lot of people tend to go quite quiet, because they can see an alternative and they can see something tangible that definitely works. I think the danger is where you get stakeholders talking about a project in the abstract, because we all have slightly different mental pictures of what that abstract is, if that makes sense.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I love, did I mention this last week on the show, Marcus, the idea that Government Digital Service won't let you be a stakeholder on a project unless you sat in on usability testing in the last 6 weeks?
No, you didn't mention that. No,
that's a great little thing that they've got to make sure that all the people that want to comment are actually A, committed to the project, and B, have at least got a user's perspective on it. They say that if you haven't been involved in user testing or interacting with the user over the last 6 weeks, you don't get to comment on the project. And so that gets rid of all the people that can't be asked but want to express an opinion. And it also ensures those that are bothered at least have the user's perspective on it, which I love. I like that plan.
Interesting. I like that too. Who keeps track of that, though?
I don't know. It's Lisa Reichelt mentioned it once, and I leapt all over it, but I never really got into the details of it.
It is a great idea.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, let's do another question. This one is from Daryl Snow. How the heck do we really work out how to charge for our work and justify our costs? Oh, a number of times I've heard that question and conversation happen. You guess, don't you? Is that not how it works?
Pretty much.
How much you could get away with?
It's not an easy question, right? I mean, what you would charge for your services is different from what I would charge for my services for a number of reasons, right? So to me, it's like a really kind of personal thing that an individual or an organization kind of needs to explore on their own. And essentially, I think starting with a really firm understanding of what you do and why you do it will help you get to that number or that answer. I also think it's a lot about educating your clients or prospective clients about what you do, what your story is, and how you think about your work and how it's valuable to your clients. Because I think once you're able to tell that story and make a positive impact, or how you might make a positive impact with them through the work that you do together, the money matters a little bit less.
You're slightly hinting there at the idea of value-based pricing. What do you think of that idea of, instead of charging based on the number of hours you do, the amount of value you bring to the project, brings to the organization?
So I don't have a ton of experience with value-based pricing, but as a project manager who has had to manage budgets against timelines and scope documents, I probably would find it a little bit difficult, right?
Mm.
Because the one thing that I always like when it comes to estimating is using a tool called a work breakdown structure, which is a pretty traditional project management tool, and it's something that the Project Management Institute would teach. And basically the idea of it is you take a task and you break it out into subtasks, and by doing that, by breaking it down and understanding all of the steps, you're able to apply a value to those things, whether that be a dollar amount, hours, minutes, weeks, however you want to estimate. So I really like the idea of having a pretty solid understanding of the effort something will take. Whereas with value-based pricing, you're basing it on the value of the customer, right?
Uh-huh.
So for me, I think more what I was getting at was, once you kind of get to that value, you can place a value on maybe what your rate is, or like how much you charge for one thing that you can kind of track against. So, but I'm open to the value-based pricing conversation. I just haven't had much experience with it.
Marcus, from a kind of sales perspective, I don't think we've ever talked on the show about your attitudes towards value-based pricing. How do you see it?
I can remember talking with, I can't remember who it was, who's a major proponent of it.
Oh, Jonathan Stark.
Yes. And I remember at the time thinking, doesn't really work for me. And to the point of, I can't really remember how it works, if I'm being completely honest.
It's like anything, mine. It's kind of vaguely open to interpretation, isn't it, in terms of how you apply it. But I think the purest view of value-based pricing says, okay, let's take a really easy one, like an e-commerce site. They've got an existing e-commerce site. You are been asked to improve the checkout process. You estimate that you can increase, by improving the checkout process, you can increase sales by, I don't know, 2%.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
Therefore,
you can calculate how much that's worth in revenue and take essentially charge a percentage of
that's
that.
That's right. And for that particular example, great. I mean, that's kind of the ad agency model, isn't it? The ad agency goes into the big corporation and says, if you work with us, we will sell you a million more cars than you are currently selling. Therefore, we're going to take 30% of that, and everybody wins. which kind of works. But if you're redesigning a logo, that's a bit harder to measure what it's worth. Yeah. And I think that's why I thought, not so sure. And also, you know, I've been doing this for ages, and as Brett just said, my mind is in the we charge for the effort we put in. And I think a way to find, you know, what the right rate for you is, you know, there are many, many places, many kind of documents that list rates for different types of, you know, designers, developers, print designers, creative directors, all those kind of things. I'm like, you could go and find one on the internet within 2 minutes. And we've done that over the years. We've even looked at some American ones. And you kind of like think, well, do our rates fit with an expectation? You know, do they fit with what a London web designer is currently, you know, average charge out for a London-based web designer? We're a little bit below that, I think. So therefore, that's right, because we're just outside London. So that's where I'd start, going back to the original question. I'd see what are the average... Well, then they're normally displayed in a kind of like, you know, the lowest to highest, and also in from a geographical point of view, and just sort of see where you are, what your experience is, what you think, where you think you should fit between those lowest and highest rates, and have a go. And if you find that you're managing to make a profit on that, then you've probably got it about right.
Okay.
I also think that there's something to be said for having a strong network of people that you can lean on. So, you know, we talked about the owner camp situation and the event that you went to, Paul. I think once you meet people who are kind of on your level and you're comfortable sharing, I think it's really easy to have conversations about benchmarking and what you do and what your services are and what you charge for it. You know, once you're comfortable in that situation, I think conversations like that can be so helpful.
Oh, absolutely.
With peers.
Yeah. But I'm slightly, although I don't think value-based pricing in the way that I've just described it would work in most situations, there is another part of me that really doesn't like having an hourly rate, that doesn't feel that works. So, for example, what people in my situation, what people are now hiring me for is my years of experience and my knowledge and expertise in a particular area. So it's perfectly feasible for me to have a half an hour conversation with somebody that gives them a huge amount of value because it's a particular problem and I can give them a solution or an approach to that problem which they would have never thought about themselves. And that's only taken me half an hour. Yet I could spend a day producing a document or a report or something like that that may not give them actually as much value in terms of insights as that 30-minute conversation is. So although I may be value-based pricing in terms of you know, how much it's about how much value I bring to the conversation as well. So I tend not to charge. I tend not to have a daily rate, you know. So if you look at one of my proposals, you won't see a breakdown of daily rates. You'll see a breakdown of tasks and a price associated to that. Now, yeah, I do have in my head a kind of, I calculate how long it's going to take me and I have a rough rate around, you know, how much I charge for that. But that's a flexible number depending on what value I think it brings.
Yeah, I know, but so, Paul, you charge a high rate, as you should, because you're highly experienced. And that's how it works. That's why creative directors are charged out, you know, more highly than a junior designer, although I can't bear all this junior, mid-level and senior stuff. But that's the way to combat that. And you just said you do still work it out in your head. I mean, all right, yeah, that half an hour piece of gold that you give somebody, well, I don't see what, you know, be thankful that you can give it to them.
It's typical. Brett, do you, for the work that you do, have a charge out rate? Because we're in very similar situations, really. You know, we're both doing consultancy work. We're both, you know, got a significant experience behind us. And I'm just interested about how you personally charge.
I handle it really similarly to you, Paul. I think, you know, on some things there might be more of an hourly rate, particularly if I'm actually going to to manage a project for someone. You know, there's typically a budget for that, right? And I have an hourly rate that I would charge for that work. And typically I would work within the budget that they have, you know, in a reasonable way. And then, you know, for some of the other more consulting work, I do think that there is a value applied to that. But then there is a target for me if I'm going to be, you know, taken out of work for a full day, and if I'm traveling somewhere, and, you know, there are a lot of things that I consider. But I also know that I have to be open to discussion about those things, because I feel like I'm so new to it. That I wouldn't want to outprice myself for someone, especially if it's a project that I'm really interested in doing. So I typically like to have conversations with prospective clients about, you know, what their budgets are and what their goals are, so that I can try to price it in a way that I think is reasonable for both of us.
I mean, I joked right at the beginning of this about making it up, but to some extent you are. You do have to feel your way over these things. There's all kinds of factors. You know, Marcus mentioned looking at, you know, your competitors and other people in the industry. You've got to take into geographic location, you know, makes a difference. Things like the value you bring makes a difference. The amount of time you spend, where you're spending that time. Are you spending it, you know, working remotely from home, or are you having to commute into somewhere? You know, things like, as you just said, Brett, how much you want to do the project. You know, if there's a project I really want to do, then I may well discount it, while another project which I'm like, I don't know if I want to do that, then they get charged a bit extra. And you know, you can lie about those kinds of things, and you can say there's some kind of specific formula that you use, but I think in truth, you know, it is all a bit of give and take and a bit of discussion and backwards and forwards over it. And I found one particular word that disturbs me in Daryl's question, which is, how do we justify our costs? That word justify, I don't feel a need to. You know, either someone can choose to hire me or they can choose not to. You know, I don't need to justify that cost.
Your justification is in the story you tell when you're talking to them on the phone or in your proposal. You're not actually justifying, this is why we charge what we charge, but you're saying, we're the right people to do this job for you. That story you're telling is the justification of your price. And as you say, Paul, if they don't like the price, then go elsewhere.
That's exactly what I was saying, Marcus. I think it's all within how you are educating your clients and explaining the value of your work to them. I think the place where people might have a harder time and need to justify costs is if, you know, a client asks for some kind of new out-of-scope request, right? Or, you know, a new project, and they just want to understand why you need to charge them so much more money to, you know, build something new or something extra. And in that case, that's when I use that work breakdown structure just to say, okay, so you really want to know why it costs so much. These are all of the things that we have to do based on the simple request that you gave us. Because a lot of times, you know, our clients, they don't know the details. They don't want to know the details. So if you can break it down in really simple terms and explain the level of effort of something, that justifies the cost.
Yeah, educating the client about the process is a big part of justifying costs and explaining costs, because you are right. A lot of the time, why should they understand what goes into it? You know,
it's not their business, right?
No, absolutely not. Okay, that brings us on to our third question. Well, it doesn't bring us on, but it's about time we moved on to our third question, which is from Glenn. And Glenn says, how can I like this? The wording of these questions is so telling. How can I drag the right information out of clients and set the correct goals for projects in the initial discovery phase? Glenn, the word drag says so much. And yes, I feel for you. Brett, this is your bread and butter. You must have to deal with this kind of stuff all the time.
Absolutely. So I think it all gets back to getting to know your clients and your stakeholders. because once you do that, you start to get information so much more easily, and they tend to just like bring things to you because they trust you and they know you and they know what you need from them. So I think it starts with your sales process, right? So if you're going to do a discovery phase, you need to talk to them early on about what they're going to do, what their role in the project is going to be, and what the information is that you're going to need from them. Because sometimes it just takes time. You know, getting back to the last question, we talked about educating clients. They don't know what you need unless you tell them. Mm-hmm. And if you make the right case for something, they're going to be on your side and get you whatever you need. It's going to take time because, you know, clients are typically, their job is many projects, yours maybe just be one of the really small ones. Mm-hmm. I also think conducting a first meeting with your point of contact once you've won the project that explores what the discovery phase is, maybe reiterating some of those things that you discussed in the sales process and reiterating what you'll need can be really important to set up a plan for how you'll get the information you need. Explaining what you're doing, why you're doing it, and why you need the info, and then talking to them about what could happen if you don't get the info you need.
Yeah.
That can definitely light a fire with people mm-hmm. who might be a little more lazy or a little reticent to give you the information you need.
Yeah.
I think in addition to that, you know, I think mostly everyone now does stakeholder interviews, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm a really big fan of project managers specifically being a part of those interviews, whether or not you're just in them and taking notes and listening for things related to project goals, potential risks, maybe some internal politics within your client organization. Hearing all of those things in a conversation can help you to move a project forward, because the more you can absorb, the better you'll do. I also like to add some questions to stakeholder interview scripts, because they tend to be specifically about the users of the product or projects, and kind of directions about marketing or maybe specifics about IT. But I think it's really important to uncover people's opinions about the goals of the project, talking to people about how they may have run similar projects, and what kind of challenges they may have had with those projects, so that you can kind of get ahead of them. Mm-hmm. And talking about potential risks, like being really open about, these are the things that I see could possibly holding us up. What do you think about them? I think all of those things are really important, and they help you to quote unquote drag that information out of your clients, you know? But it's all just about like opening up a dialogue and talking about the project as a partnership. And, you know, as soon as you build that partnership and that relationship, things just seem to come a little easier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think personal experience is you need to speak to as senior people as you possibly can. That's really important. And don't avoid, I was going to say difficult situation, not really that, but you often find with very senior people that you'll get cancelled at the last minute and or whatever, and then it'll get cancelled again, and then things are getting delayed. Is just kind of make sure that those meetings with senior people do happen, even if it's just over the phone or whatever. I think that's that if you don't do that, if you avoid that, then you will be missing the right information. That's my personal opinion.
I think as well, I think sometimes it's how we present an initial discovery phases, because even the term discovery phase, it's got this kind of implication in it that it's for us, right? We're the outside people coming in, and we need to learn about all of this stuff before we're capable of delivering the project, right? And the implication there is that, well, it doesn't have any real value for the client, right? So because it's about us learning rather than the client getting something from it, and as a result, clients are going to be a little bit reticent to put a lot of work into it, really. You know, this is your problem kind of thing. So I'm always careful when I create proposals to make sure that that discovery phase has deliverables of its own that bring some kind of tangible value to the client. So, for example, if I do stakeholder interviews, I make sure that there is just a very light report that goes alongside that, that you know, flags certain key issues that the client isn't necessarily aware of or doesn't need know what's going on. If we do user surveys, I make sure that that information gets back to the client and provides value to the client, just so that they're more engaged with the process because it can provide tangible benefit to them.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I also like the idea, and I don't know if you guys have done this, but a lot of agencies will sign clients for just an initial discovery phase or whatever you call it. To really, and selling that, it really can kind of explain why you need to do it and the information that you need to build the goals, to talk about how you'll get the project done together. I think is really important. I've also been in that situation where, from the agency perspective, there were enough red flags for us to say, sorry, I think we're going to have to walk away from this project. But here is the work that came out of it. And with it is a brief and what we think you need and a potential plan for how it will get done. And you can go to someone else and try to execute that.
Which is great, because that's great for the client as well, because the client can equally go, well, thank you very much for the plan that you've given us and all the information, but we don't feel you're right either. Yep, so it's exactly, a way of testing the relationship at a low risk because they haven't signed up for a massive big project.
Yep. And as a project manager, I love that approach because there's nothing worse than getting stuck in a 9-month project with someone you can't stand.
Yeah.
And someone who demotivates the team and you know things are going to be held up. So
As a salesman, I love that as well, because if we're sort of going from discovery right through to delivery of some new site or something like that, chances are I'm guessing about what it's going to cost the later, further down the line. Whereas if you can do a discovery phase first, you're going to have a much better idea of actual cost.
Exactly.
So there we go.
Definitely. I think we answered that one.
Yeah. We have answered that one. You want to do your discovery phase as a separate project up front and you'll be sorted. All right, well, we'll wrap up at that point. There's hundreds of questions and we could keep going. And no doubt we'll have Brett back on the show to answer some more questions later in the season if he's up for it. But right now, I just want to talk about our second sponsor of the day, which is Quilla. So last week we talked about how Quilla allows you to create great looking proposals. And it really is a superb tool that I have to say, I switched to it relatively recently. And I swear that my conversion rate has gone up, although I haven't actually got enough hard data to be able to judge. But it feels like things are going really well. So that's great. And to a large extent, it's just because the proposals look great and they're compelling, etc. But it's got some powerful functionality in it beyond just making your proposals look great that I did want to focus on. And one is the fact that you can have optional items. So you can have like a pricing grid of all the different things, you know, stakeholder interview, usability testing, user surveys, whatever. You can break down your proposal and you can have costs against each one. But you can also say that some of those items are optional. So they can go through if they want and say, no, I don't want you doing a user survey, but I definitely want you doing stakeholder interviews. But you can even go further. You can say, okay, we recommend doing 6 stakeholder interviews, but if they want to go for more, they can go in and increase the number. And you can set a minimum and a maximum, so they can put
999.
Exactly. Yeah, and you'd want to kill yourself, but you can set a minimum and a maximum on that, and it will increment the price accordingly. So it means that they can play around with the proposal. And of course, this is great for getting around some of the issues that you have about you go in and pitch a number that might be wildly too high or wildly too low. You know, this allows them to tailor the proposal for themselves. And even better, they can then go in, once they've set it up the way they want, and sign off there and then online to it. So they can go through and, you know, and do an e-signature. So it's got a full audit tracking. It's as good as signing a contract. You can include your terms and conditions and everything else, all straight on the proposal. And in fact, if you have a situation, this obviously wouldn't apply to the kind of work that any Marcus, Brett or myself do, but maybe if you do smaller websites, they can even go in and at that point and pay the deposit online there and then. So you could do all kinds of great things. And then behind the scenes as well, you've got great analytics, so you get notifications when people have viewed your proposal, all kinds of goodies. So you can get a free trial for that, so you can give it a go, play with it yourself, see what you think of it by going to boag.world/proposal. But you can also get 50% off for 3 months if you use the promo code BOAG, B-O-A-G. So that about wraps it up for this week. Remember to send in some more questions. We are excited to see what great questions that you've got for this season. I think it's going to be a good one. Marcus, do you have a joke for us?
Yeah, more from Nick Johnson Hill, which are all nice quick ones, which I'm sure you'll be very glad to hear. What's the difference between a well-dressed man on a unicycle and a poorly dressed man on a bike?
Okay, go on.
Attire.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Wah, wah.
Yeah. Nick has really found your level, hasn't he?
He's found exactly the type of joke I like. So there you go. And you're just going to have to put up with it for a few more weeks. And then I'll have to go and find more.
That's fine. No, we can keep going. Yeah, there was something I just wanted to mention to people before we go, which is that I'm really trying to push the podcast a little bit more at the moment. So I would really appreciate it if people would take the time to pop along to iTunes or wherever and write us a review of what you think of it, presuming that it's a nice review. If it's not a nice review, don't bother. Just leave it. Right.
Yeah.
But if you think you can say nice things about the show, it'd be really appreciated. Okay, that's it for this week. Next week we're going to be joined by someone from Clear Left.
Ooh.
One of their project managers. They've got two project managers and they can't make up their mind between them which one wants to come on the show first. We'll probably get both of them eventually.
Let's have both of them.
Well, yeah, but I only want one at a time.
Okay.
Well, because so
we can sort of shine the spotlight on them and find out their innermost.
No, does that mean they're going to pick their favorite first?
I don't know. Ooh. I think it's just going to be who's not on holiday or who's not too busy.
Okay, that's
the reason I was only the reason I said one of them, Marcus, was because I was thinking of you and having to sync all those different audio files together.
I was kind of hoping they'd be in the same room, but yeah, you're right. Thank you, Paul.
See, I consider you.
Yes.
All right, then. That's it for this week. Brett, huge thanks for coming on the show. Some great answers to those questions. And hopefully we'll have you back on soon.
I would love to. Thank you so much. Good time,
thank everybody for listening as well. Much appreciated. And see you next week. Goodbye. Oh,